said earlier, this is a much more reflective kind of session. No PowerPoint, just some reflections of... I actually slightly changed the title of my talk. The trouble of being a personality like I am is you are written to many, many months in advance, and they say, what are you going to talk about? And you go, well, I have no idea. It's many months away. So then you make something up. And then when the moment comes and you're writing the talk, you go, oh, no, I didn't want to talk about that at all. I wanted to talk about something else. Thanks, Steph. So that's what happened when I was writing this. I started intending writing to you just about imagination, and it went off in a different direction. So it was a bit about imagination and a bit about other things. Because what I've subtitled this talk, the subtitle of this talk is, when I started writing Phoebe, what I was trying to do and what happened. Those of you who do writing, and all of you will do it in some way or another, will probably recognise this, which is that, you know, when you sit down and you go, I'm going to write this sermon, essay, blog, book, depending on what you're doing, and what I'm going to do is, I wonder how many of you actually end up with the thing that you thought you were going to end up doing. I never have, under any circumstances. So I thought you might be interested in my reflections about what happened and what I learnt while I was writing, and just kind of reflections around that and what I've learnt from it. So there are kind of three to four things, we'll see how the time goes, that I wanted to talk to you about. But for those of you who don't know my book, I just wanted to kind of introduce what I was trying to do so you can get a sense of, because it's an unusual thing that I was attempting to do. What I wanted to try and do was to write a story that would get us into Pauline theology in a different way than most books on Pauline theology try and get us into. And the reason why I wanted to do that is that a lot of Pauline theology, as I was illustrating this morning, actually, is entirely conceptual. It's about ideas and thinking and how you put your head around it. And one of the reasons why a lot of people don't like Paul is because they don't think conceptually. I discovered something in research for my next book, which I'm now working on, which is on the parables, a really interesting quotation from someone called Klein Snodgrass. I'm sure he's had to suffer his name the whole of his life. But it's a really, really good book called Stories with Intent. And he's talking about the importance of stories. And it gripped me and I went, that's what I was doing. That was it. So he says that we all know that actually the way in which we learn, so this is, I'm paraphrasing rather than reading, the way in which we learn is through concrete stories. The ways in which we get our biggest learning in life is through stories about stuff, stories about people. But the problem is you can't store enough stories in your head. So what you do is you boil them down into abstract ideas because they're easier to store in your head. The mistake we make, he said, when we are preaching and teaching is we just take the abstract ideas out of our head and present them to people, forgetting that we learnt through the story and not through the abstract idea. And I went, that is genius, because that is absolutely the case. And one of the reasons that I think we often struggle, particularly in preaching, but not solely in preaching, is that we just try and give people ideas. And people go, yeah, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I can't kind of get my head around the idea. So what I was trying to do in Phoebe was to do the story bit, the learning bit, although I hadn't read Snodgrass at that point, so I hadn't realised quite what I was attempting to do. So let me begin by telling you why I was tantalised by the story of Phoebe, and then I'll tell you a few things about what I learned. You will probably know that Phoebe appears in Romans 16, verses 1 to 2. And she appears in all sorts of fascinating ways. Just two verses, but Paul kind of lobs in such interesting information about her that he kind of hangs in the air in a very tantalising way. So let me just remind you of what he says in Romans 16, 1 to 2. So he starts by saying, I commend to you Phoebe. So it's very clear from the language that he uses that Phoebe has brought the letter to the Romans from Corinth, where it's clear that she lived, to Rome. He then goes on to say she's a deacon of Kenchreae. Kenchreae is a harbour port in Corinth, so clearly she's brought it. We can't entirely know from the Pauline chronology what Paul was doing in Corinth at that point, but he clearly was in Corinth at that point. So she brought the letter from Corinth to Rome. And the word that he uses to describe her, that word commend, is actually a technical word used in Greek letters. And it was used by people when they were trying to say, this person represents me. So when people were ambassadors, they would say, I commend this person to you. And the idea is that you treat this person like they're me. So if I say, I commend to you so-and-so, the idea is that they become to you like I am. So that's really interesting as a first point of contact for Phoebe. And I will say a few things this afternoon that some of you will find a little bit controversial. If you disagree with me, it's absolutely fine. I genuinely don't mind. Do feel free to. But for me... but I know what I think and I'm going to tell you. For me, the really interesting thing is, if Phoebe has brought the letter from Corinth to Rome, she's been with Paul in Corinth while he's writing the letter, and then he says, I commend to you, Phoebe. Just imagine the Romans listened to the epistle to the Romans for the very first time. I know it's quite hard to get your head around, but it's just possible they didn't understand absolutely everything that they heard. So if they didn't understand absolutely everything that they heard, it is quite possible that they would have asked Phoebe, because she was there when he wrote it. She'd have gone, what did he mean? You know, in Romans 8, when he was talking about, what did he mean by that? Which therefore makes Phoebe the first ever exegete of Romans. As a female Pauline scholar, and there's not a lot of us around, that makes me incredibly happy. It also means that I feel that I'm in apostolic succession from Phoebe. Which is also a very lovely thought for me. So Phoebe may have been the first exegete of Romans, the first person who broke open Paul's significant theological teaching. Paul says that she is a deacon of the church in Kenchreae. Now, those of you who know anything about early studies in the diaconate will know that this is a really, really frustrating reference, because what we want to know is what it meant. The problem is that Paul knew what it meant, Phoebe knew what it meant, clearly the church in Kenchreae knew what it meant, the church in Rome knew what it meant, because Paul didn't explain it. You can feel them all going, oh, a deacon, excellent. The trouble is, he didn't tell us what he meant. So we are left with this question hanging. It's clear it is a something. It's not just that she was a servant. The way in which he sets up the sentence makes it clear it's a title of some kind. The trouble is, we don't know what kind. We just have to live with the fact that she had some kind of role that the Corinthians recognised, Paul recognised, and the Romans recognised, and then we have to leave it there and not have anything more than that. The next thing Paul says about Phoebe in Romans 16 is that she is, and this is where you get into interesting translations, she is a something of many. The Greek word is prostatis. You will find in different translations it rendered in different ways. So there are some translations that have it as a helper. The NRSV has it as a benefactor. If you were to come across these words, it is incidentally a masculine noun, not a feminine noun, intriguingly, although there are some textual variants in which it's turned into a feminine noun. But in the most of the variants of Romans 16, it's a masculine noun. And when you find it in Greek letters which are not in the New Testament, you would most naturally translate that word as patron, which is a very, very significant word. If you know anything about Roman culture, you will know that Roman culture ran on patronage. So there would be a wealthy patron, and there would be clients who worked for the wealthy patron. And what they would do in the morning, if you know, I don't know if any of you have ever studied Latin, people like Catullus talk about their patron. What would happen would be the clients would line up outside the patron's house in the morning if they needed some work, and their patron was the one they always went to. You were weren't allowed to go to another one just because you fancied it. You would stay with your main patron. And then they would give you work. It might be that they would ask you to write them a letter. They might send you to the market to buy oranges. They might ask you, in the case of Catullus, to write some dodgy poetry. They might have some sculpture. But there's all sorts of things that they would do. And the clients were supported by the patrons. So what we know, therefore, is that patrons were really significant in Roman society. They were wealthy. They were influential. They had authority. That's the word that Paul uses of Phoebe. I shall leave you to make of it what you will. But I think it is absolutely fascinating that Paul says, I commend to you this person. She's a deacon of the church, whatever that meant, and she is a patron of many. And just hear how different it sounds if you translate it as Phoebe was a patron of many or Phoebe was a helper of many. It kind of gives you a different mental picture of what's going on. And it won't surprise you to know that I've gone the patron end and not the helper end. So, she brought the letter. She probably exegeted the letter. She was a deacon. She was a patron. And then this is where the imagination stuff comes in, and this is where I began to be tantalised, is that most of the commentaries on Romans just put a little kind of giveaway statement when they're talking about Phoebe and then move on. And their little giveaway statement about Phoebe is, the name Phoebe was most often used in the Roman world of slaves. And you want to go, stop. You've just established that she was a patron, and most commentators on Romans do say that she was a patron. So she's a patron, and she's got a slave name. Are you not interested in this at all? To which the answer clearly is, no, we're not. I, however, was very interested in it. And that's where I got into the question of imagination and biblical interpretation. Let me be very, very clear about what I'm saying this afternoon and what I'm not saying. I am not saying that imagination is the only tool in biblical interpretation worth having. I'm a biblical scholar, I'm not going to say that. I've trained for years with all sorts of other tools. But what I've noticed is that actually without imagination, you miss a really important bit of biblical interpretation. It's that bit, which I've just illustrated there. If you just want to slap down in your commentary, she was a deacon, she was a patron, she used to be a slave, let's move on. Actually, you miss something really important about who this person might have been. So one of the things I think is really significant about using imagination in engaging with the text is it allows you into some of those cracks, the moments in the text where you go, well, what's that about? What does that mean for us? It doesn't mean you provide an answer. I think the really important thing is lots of people do lots of different aspects of imagination, because then you get lots of different answers. But it gets you into something that allows you to recognise something very important. There are other things, but I think that's a really significant feature. The final thing I want to tell you about Phoebe before I get on to the kind of the key things that I noticed while I was writing is that in Romans 15, Paul says that he wants to set up the Spanish mission. He wants to set up a mission to Spain. And that this is his really, really important passion at this point in his life. In fact, I would argue that that's why he wrote Romans. He didn't write Romans to write a really significant theological treatise. He was writing Romans to persuade the Romans why it was so important that he went on mission to Spain. This is the gospel, he's saying, and isn't it so important to proclaim the gospel to the people in Spain? Have I told you enough about what the gospel is? Right, I'm telling you again, this is what the gospel is. Now do you see why I've got to go to Spain? Is basically what I think he's doing in Romans. So Phoebe has brought the letter from Corinth to Rome, and it's quite clear that she's got a job to do from Romans 15. That what we can put to, if you put together your pieces from Romans and then if you kind of use bits of Acts, it's clear that what Paul was going to do is he sent the letter to the Romans so that the Spanish mission was ready to go. He was just going to pop to Jerusalem. If you remember what happened at that point in his life, all the way round Greece, he's been making a collection for the church in Jerusalem that was bound in famine. He was really worried about them, so he collected the money from the Greek churches. He was going to pop it into Jerusalem on his way to Rome. If you also know your acts, you'll know it didn't quite happen that way. The popping didn't happen quite so quickly as he had intended. He got imprisoned. He was held in prison first in Caesarea Philippi, then Caesarea, not Caesarea Philippi, in Caesarea, then in Jerusalem, then was taken prisoner to Rome. So he was very much slower than he had intended. But still the intention was that he was going to get to Rome. So the other thing we know about Phoebe, therefore, is that she was sent to set up Paul's most important mission to Rome. So these pieces of information, for me, kind of jump off the page and require us to get our heads around what was going on. What did Paul think about? What was he trying to get Phoebe to do? And that's why I wanted to write a story around it, to see if I could get into the heart of some of the stuff that happened. So that's what I was trying to do. A few things that happened along the way that you might be interested in. So the reason why I wanted to do it was because I was tantalised by these little pieces of information from Romans. The other reason I wanted to do it were for all those people I meet, and believe me, there's a lot of them, who go, Paul's not for me, don't like him, can't read his letters, don't like the theology, hate Romans, it goes on and on. And in fact, I often have highly entertaining conversations with people where they go, oh, what do you do? And you go, well, I'm a New Testament scholar. Oh, what part of the New Testament? Paul. And you could just see people's faces going, oh, quick, there must be someone else to talk to around here. There are people, and I hope there are some here, who, like me, absolutely love the writings of Paul. But there are quite a lot of people in our churches who don't. And what I was trying to do was to find a way of communicating to the people who don't that actually Paul is the most amazing thinker that you will ever come across. And you need to try and get into his thinking in order to understand what's going on and why it's so important. So that's what I was trying to do. That's what I intended to do. What I discovered was something that for me was absolutely fascinating, probably inevitable, but absolutely fascinating. Two things. One thing is that actually we slip into a kind of a sloppy way of thinking about Paul, which is an interesting sloppy way of thinking. The assumption is that the modern world is the only place that has a varied different responses to Paul. So you've got, kind of Luther's response, the new perspective on Paul's response, and then Douglas Campbell's response to the new perspective on Paul, and on you go with the different kind of perspectives. But that everyone in the first century all reacted to Paul in the same way. And people, you find it actually written very regularly in Pauline scholarship, the assumption that everyone just went, oh yes, silly us, that's the way to do theology. To which point I always want to go, have you ever read Corinthians? Because it's quite clear that the Corinthians didn't do that. The Corinthians said, who do you think you are coming here telling us how to do our theology? And it kind of became a kind of a complex relationship. And I would bet that a good half of the Corinthians were never persuaded by Paul. There's evidence, I think, to argue that they were not persuaded by Paul. And that's what began to make me realise that there's something that happens with Paul which is more visceral than happens almost with any other author in the Bible, which is that Paul evokes a response in people. It's not always positive, the response, but he does evoke a response. And for me, one of the interesting questions is, what is it about Paul and the way he writes his theology that evokes response? So what I discovered while I was writing the book is that actually there's a whole load of things that mean that we will respond to Paul in different ways. Some of the things are to do with our background. Some of the things are to do with the way in which we think. Some of the things are to do with what's going on in our lives now. And what I realised as I was writing is that you can begin to trace some of those things as you're doing biblical interpretation. If you are a Jewish Christian, you will relate to Paul differently than if you're a Gentile Christian. If you're someone who's a slave, you will react to Paul differently than someone who has always been free. If you are somebody who has recently been adopted, you will relate to Paul differently than somebody who has never been adopted, and so on. So therefore, actually, we need to pay attention to personal circumstance in order to understand biblical interpretation. Then, and now. And if you can illustrate it then, it becomes clearer now how it is that we respond to Paul and what's going on in our responses to Paul. It's often said of historical Jesus scholarship that if it kind of is kind of badly paraphrased, but somebody once said that historical Jesus scholarship is like looking down a well and seeing your own reflection. Historical Jesus looks inordinately like the person who's writing about it. And I've always been really struck by that, because it is true also of Paul. If you think about the descriptions that people have of Paul, they look remarkably like the person writing. And the reason, one of the reasons I say this, is that one of my tutors when I was an undergraduate, or my main tutor when I was an undergraduate, is Tom Wright, who has had an enormous impact on me, my thinking, and is really why I'm a Pauline scholar. But Paul looks incredibly like Tom Wright in Tom Wright's writings. It is a very, very striking thing. He thinks like Tom Wright. He expresses himself like Tom Wright. And sometimes we forget and call him Paul Wright, because he is so, as we imagine Paul to be. And I don't say that in any way to denigrate Tom Wright's writings. He is a fabulous theologian. He's a brilliant writer. I think he understands Paul better than anyone else I know. And yet, the Paul he writes about looks like him. And therefore, shock news, the Paul I write about looks remarkably like me. And I know that. And I think there is something that we need to have clear in our minds when we're thinking about biblical interpretation, is that try as we might to do exegesis and not eisegesis, nevertheless, we end up looking at ourselves in the text. And half of me wants to say, well, that's okay, so long as we know we've done it. That's the really key thing. The danger of it is when we don't know we've done it, and we go, well, no, that's really what it says. And then somebody comes along and says, well, it doesn't look like that to me. And it's also, incidentally, why reading with different cultures is such an important thing, because different cultures come with a different perspective on what the text looks like. So that's one thing that I learned. The other thing that I learned is that actually we need to be slightly more confident on the importance of imagination. And that really has gripped me as I wrote the book, is that I started off feeling very, very apologetic about the fact that I was using imagination as a tool. And if you have read the book, or if you go on to read the book, you'll see in the notes I start with a big introduction about how I'm very sorry, I'm not very good at writing fiction, and it's not really a novel, and you mustn't take it too seriously. And I realised that what I was doing was apologising for doing what I was about to be doing. And the reason why that is because imagination is deemed by the Christian world, the scholarly world, not to be a valid tool of writing and imagination. As I wrote, I became more and more convinced that it not only was a valid tool, it's a vital tool. You've got a big toolkit, and you do need your original languages, and you need your historical critical aspects, and you need your other aspects of writing. But you also need imagination, because without it, you miss something really, really important. So just a couple of things on why I think imagination is so very important. The first thing is that, let's be honest, we do it all the time anyway, and then we pretend we haven't. And for people who tell me that they would never use imagination as a tool for reading the Bible, I say to them, I raise you the Christmas Nativity play. It's a really important thing to bear in mind, is that so let me just tell you a little story which illustrates this beautifully. As a New Testament scholar, you get invited to do fun things and more difficult things. And once I was invited to do what I thought was going to be a fun thing. In Britain, children's television in my era, when I was young, very, very many years ago, the big programme was Blue Peter. Anyone heard of Blue Peter? And I just thought Blue Peter was the most amazing thing. It's still going, it's less successful now. And about 5 years ago, I got a phone call saying, would you like to come on Blue Peter? I just went, yes, yes, I would love to come on Blue Peter. Then I discovered what they were asking me to do, and I went, oh no. So what they were going to do was set up a tableau of the Christmas Nativity scene. And then I was going to come in as a New Testament scholar and tell them what was not in the original text. it'll surprise you to know, it turned out I was ill that day and nearly unable to do it. But it was one of those kind of horrendous asks. Oh, we're being upsetting, I'm sorry. But it was one of those absolutely horrendous requests to me. Because actually, the problem is, as you will know, the answer is almost nothing. Almost nothing you can have. Or you would have to go, well, which bit of... Are you using Luke or are you using Matthew? You can't have an inn. You can't have a donkey. You can't have an innkeeper. You can't have an innkeeper's wife or an innkeeper's child. You can't have, you know, you name it, you can't have it in the nativity set. And then people say to me, well, surely therefore we need to have biblically accurate nativity stories. To which point I go, no, it would take you 30 seconds and then you'd all be done. We use our imagination and it's really important. The key thing, as I've said already, but let me say it again, is not whether you use your imagination or not, it's whether you know you've used your imagination or not, and whether you are aware of what you've put in to help with grace notes, you know, that helps you lift the story off the page. And that for me is a really, really significant thing. And as we recognise that, you then recognise that we do it all the time. I bet you've got a mental image of what Paul looks like. Not based on any historical reality, other than if you've read the Acts of Paul and Thecla, which give you a rather unflattering image of Paul, who is bow-legged with eyebrows that meet in the middle and humpbacked. But there's a chance that you've got a mental image of Paul. You think you know what Jesus looks like. You've got an idea of what a church might have looked like in the first century. You can't help but kind of supply some imaginative detail when you're looking. So for me, I want to say, well, let's use that imaginative detail, but let's do a little bit of historical investigation before we do. So let's actually see what we might know about what a first century church could look like. Let's have a think about whether we can understand what a house was like in the Roman period. So when you're imagining Paul visiting a house, you've actually got an actual house in your head and not one that looks like a lovely Australian semi. You know, let's inform our imagination with all sorts of things. So, as you will gather, as I was writing, I became absolutely passionate about the importance of imagination. And for me, the really significant thing is what doing that means is that you lift theology off the page and land it in the heart. I think it's very hard for ideas to land in the heart in the way that stories can land in the heart. And as I've been doing this, I've become more and more convinced we need to be better at this in our preaching. If we want our preaching to land in people's hearts, there's a good chance you need to use stories in some way or another. Of course, the way that we were all taught to preach is that you use an illustration and then you get onto the meaty theology stuff. The problem is, you talk to people about your sermons and they'll remember the illustration and not the meaty theological stuff. If there is a way of wrapping our imagination into the theological meaty theological stuff, then actually you've got a hope of people being able to reflect on it a little bit more. So there's something I think very important in that. First point. Second point. This is where I'm getting more controversial. So, like I say, do disagree with me if you would like to. The thing that I became really gripped by while I was writing this is, you know, the passages we talk about all the time about women in Paul. You know them. 1 Timothy 2, 1 Corinthians 14, 1 Corinthians 11. What we do is we focus on them when we talk about women and Paul and Paul's attitude to women in ministry, women in leadership, and how we kind of think about that. What's interesting, though, is that they are all passages about notional women. They're the ideas of women. Do I think that this idea of a woman ought to do that thing? What happens if you start in a different place is those passages start to look different. So if you start with actual women rather than notional women, then what Paul says about women changes its flavour. So, just to give you an illustration, think about Phoebe. I've just told you that it is likely that Phoebe was the first exegete of Romans. We know that she was a deacon, though we don't know what it meant. We know that she was a wealthy and influential person in her society. And at no point anywhere in any of his writings does Paul say, and she shouldn't. So therefore, what we have are pictures of actual women, and Paul goes, great, I commend Phoebe to you, carry on. Which then means that, in my view, what we need to do is take the actual women, and you will probably know there are lots of them, we can talk about Phoebe, we'll probably just bracket out Junior because we've talked about her so often and it gets a bit difficult, but how about we put in Prisca and Nympha and Euodia and Syntyche and Lois and you name it. There are so many women mentioned by Paul, and at no point does Paul ever say of any of those women, I do wish Prisca would stop telling Apollos off for his theology, or I do wish that Phoebe wouldn't exegete Romans, or I do wish that Nympha wouldn't have a church that met in her house. He doesn't do it. He just acknowledges them as actual women. If you start there, then the passages begin to look very different. We haven't got the time to talk about them, but it does kind of cast a different light, and it requires us to think differently about those passages. Second point. So, and then the third point, which is probably a good place to end. What I was trying to do, so many things I was trying to do, but one of the things I was trying to do was to find a voice for those women that you can feel are lurking in the text, but you can't quite hear them because they aren't given a voice. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could hear the voice of some of those women? And what I discovered while I was looking for Phoebe's voice was my voice. And I'm going to get a bit emotional now because actually it was such an enormous thing for me. I was very struck by Jude talking about how we do theological discourse. And it may have occurred to you, may have noticed, that there are certain disciplines in theology where that way of doing discourse are stronger than other ways of doing discourse. Two of the most foremost of those are systematic theology and Pauline studies. That's where you do the combative discourse, in which I say something, you find something wrong with it, therefore demonstrate that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing in the first place. And that's kind of often how it kind of functions in the way in which these things work. If I'm honest, I stopped going to New Testament conferences and Paul parts of it because I found it too emotionally exhausting. There would be me and a handful of other women and a room full of men who were all lovely, don't get me wrong, they were all lovely men, but the discourse alienated me. I couldn't find a way to engage with it, and I really struggled. And I was contemplating giving up when I started writing Phoebe. And then as I wrote, I went, there's a different way of doing this. There's a different way of finding your voice. I'm not suggesting that where I found my voice is where you'll find your voice. But what I would really encourage you to do is to listen to your inner self. Now, if you love combative discourse, can I recommend to you systematic theology and Pauline studies? There are some women who love it, in which place, go. That the area needs you. But actually, if you don't love it, don't give up, would be what I would say to you. Find your voice. Find a way to be who you are. Find the way to express what's in your heart in a way that resonates with you, in a way that makes you feel comfortable with saying it. We need to be clear about what happens when you do it, and I'm very clear about what happens when you do it, and my doctoral supervisor was also very clear about this. So my doctoral supervisor was someone called Chris Rowland, who was a remarkable man. And while I was writing my doctorate, I was struggling again with the whole discourse thing. And I said, I don't want to write it like this. I want to write it differently. And he said, would you like a doctorate? And I said, yes, I would like a doctorate. And he said, well, in that case, you have to follow the rules. You don't have to afterwards, but you do have to then. So there's two things to know. If you're working at graduate level and you want a qualification, there are rules. You have to write in the language. Do it, because you want what you get out of the end of it. But if you're not working in graduate studies, and if actually you've come out of the end of graduate studies, don't feel you've got to carry on talking like that. You can talk like something else. But don't expect the discipline to recognise you. It's just one of those things. And I have reconciled in myself that actually I'm more interested in having ordinary Christians get excited about doing Pauline theology than I am about the Pauline Academy taking me seriously. So I'm good with it. But you do need to recognise what you're doing and where you will end up. But I think it's really, really important to listen to your inner voice, the one that says, actually, I've got something to say, and it's a really important thing that I want to say, and I need to find a way to say it. So can I just take the end of this conference as the opportunity to say to you, find it. You won't regret it. And what I've discovered is that I kind of found half my voice writing Phoebe, and I think I know what I want to do next, so I'm going to have another go and see if I can find the whole voice. Probably won't. I'll probably be on my deathbed going, I know how to do it now. But I haven't quite got there. So I'm going to have another go at a book like Phoebe, but it's going to be called Lydia. And it's going to be based on Philippians, because it's another area that's waiting to be done. And I'll see if I can do a better crack at it the second time around. So that's enough from me, I think. We've got time for about 10 minutes. So we've got 10 minutes of questions in which you can ask me almost... Oh, Anthea's straight in. I was about to tell you what you can ask me. You can ask me anything at all, Anthea.
Thank you for talking about evangelical suspicion about the whole process of... Because I think I have experienced that myself. Yeah. So writing something and then getting sort of shut down.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't do it like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because it's all about the word.
Yeah.
And you don't need anything extra.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. But my question was, you talked about for yourself knowing the difference between what's kind of from the text
yes.
of scripture, what's grounded in good scholarship and what's imagination. Is it important for your reader to know the difference? And how would they tell the difference?
Yeah. Yes. Footnotes. And so that's why I'm also clear that I haven't written a novel, because this is a story with footnotes, and the footnotes are the key to it. Because what I've wanted to try and do is to say, this is what we know, or we may, this is what we think, or this is where the debate is, and I've gone in this direction, so that people actually know what the debate is. And do you know what's been absolutely lovely is I've had lots and lots of emails from people who've gone, yeah, quite like the story, love the footnotes. And it's made me very, very happy indeed, because what I think the story has done is allowed people to recognise that they actually do want to know, you know, they want to know what a first century Roman house was like. If I'd said, would you like to know what a first century Roman house is like, they'd have gone, no thanks. But through a story, they suddenly go, oh yeah, I never thought about that. And then they look at the footnote and go, oh right, yeah, I get that now. So it's about, in a way, it's kind of a way of gracing the information that you want to give to people. So here's the fascinating question for preaching. How would you do that? How would you do that in a sermon? I'm sure it's possible to do it, I just haven't quite cracked it yet. But is there a way of doing a narrative in a sermon and then leaving some hooks at the end that people could then ask questions about or something? I don't know, but there must be a way. On a biblical passage, yeah, that's right. Because I think, for me, that's one of the things that kind of really brings the text off the page, is some kind of narrative, but also the way for people then to go. Because the other thing that has made my kind of year are the number of people who said, I've never read Romans all the way through. I finished Phoebe, went and read Romans all the way through. And that's what I would want to do also in preaching, is, right, now I want to go and look at the text. What does it really say? And it's kind of as a tool into closer attention. Text reading. Steph.
Someone like C.S. Lewis is respected as both a creative writer and as an intellectual scholar, one of the most intellectual Christians of the 20th century. Would you say that takes a very special, unique kind of person, or is it possible for women who have a creative and an intellectual street to kind of mingle them in an effective way, or is it more effective?
It's a great question, and in a way I don't know the answer, because not enough people have tried yet. My initial response is, he was a male Oxford Don, which kind of helped in terms of intellectual respectability. But I also think, and I think that's why I really wanted to talk to you all about this, is that part of the issue is that what I've done is quite unusual, and people go, what was she doing? Actually, if a lot of us start doing it, then people might begin to see a genre shift. You know, that actually, it's not just me with my mad ideas. Actually, there is a way of doing this. That so there becomes a, you know, the way in which an academic field arises is if enough of people write in a certain area, then the field emerges. So what if we made an academic field?
You know, Marilyn Robinson
is just, but not respected as an academic. That's that. So it is, but so therefore it's like kind of that, how do we get those kind of things? I've just realised I've left me.